Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another exciting episode we have here of Climate Science Radio, of course hosted by DP Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show is called Spy versus Spy versus Spy, an interview with the queen of espionage, Gail Lenz. So hey, without any further ado, here are your hosts of the show, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, hello everyone, I want to welcome you to this edition of Climate Science Radio. We have our dear friend Gail Lenz on today. I'm not sure Jan's going to make it on board today, and actually right now we're waiting on Gail to call in, and I hope she's doing that right now, but I'll tell you a little bit about her while we're waiting. She began her career in writing as a reporter for the Arizona Republic, and there she did a lot of investigative reports, and some of it even led to changes in legislation. Later, she became an editor with a top-secret security clearance at a government think tank, and where she was involved in a lot of the secret stuff. So she has a background in espionage and understanding how these things work out there in the real world. Soon she began writing stories, and she began actually with literary short stories, and they were published in many journals. And at the same time, she began writing pulp novels in the Nick Carter and Mac Bolan series. Talk about a dichotomy there. And now she's evolved into a New York Times best-selling author that everyone knows, and she's written a ton of great books. Her most recent one is called The Assassins. And it's available for pre-order now. I think it's probably not. I think it's going to be released June 30th. And I see Gail just sent me an email and said she called in but got cut off. I'm not sure what that means. So I guess she's calling back.
Hey, Doug. Yeah. I just want to let you know that we do have Gail online. Something happened. Yes, she did say could have been the internet, but that's okay. So we want to welcome Gail Lenz here to the show. So, Gail, here you are. You're live now with Doug Lyle.
Oh, how exciting. I'm thrilled.
Hey, Gail, how you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. Snow
well, I
in.
Just introduced you and gave all the flowery information about your wonderful career to our listeners. And so let me just ask you this. I said in the intro that you started as an investigative reporter for the Arizona Republic.
Right.
What was that all about? How did you end up there?
It was one of those wonderful serendipities in life. My then husband was working. We just graduated from college and moved to Phoenix, where my husband had a job at a law firm. And I was fortunate enough to get a general assignment reporter's job. It was a very, very interesting way to learn about life, because they sent me on everything from murder investigations or to interview the governor. Ultimately, I ended, and of course, movie stars were always calling in because it was a great place to film movies. So that was fun. And then I sat on the obituaries desk for 2 weeks, which was not fun. Oh, Lord. But my favorite thing that I got to do is towards the end of the time that I was there, they allowed me to do a real investigative piece. And this one was about children who were mentally handicapped. There were several homes for them in the Phoenix area. And so I started doing a study of all of them, the various kinds of treatment that they were receiving and how it was working and what their group homes were like. And as I was working through all of this, I noticed that I was being followed around when I would go into the state house to get some facts and figures on it. And when I start, and I'm no mathematician, mind you, but I do add and subtract pretty well. So I started adding and subtracting, and I realized that they were taking in a lot more money than they were spending. Someplace that money was going somewhere else. And we published it. It was, I think, a three-part series in the Arizona Republic, which was the largest newspaper in the state. The result was new legislation, and I was always so proud of that.
Well, yeah. Especially people who are pilfering from the handicapped.
Yeah, and I don't think they ever figured out where the money went, which is unfortunate. But at least they increased the controls so that it was unlikely it was going to happen again.
Well, because you were such a good investigative reporter, you moved on to the government and had top secret clearance. What is that all about, and how does someone get top secret clearance?
Well, actually, the truth is, that was Kurt Vonnegut's fault. And you may remember that that Kurt Vonnegut was, because he's passed away now, a phenomenal writer. And I had gone to the University of Iowa, where he had been a guest lecturer in one of my lit classes, and he talked about how he wrote Cat's Cradle. I don't know if you remember that, but in those years it was a very, very popular book and received
Still
a number
is.
Of awards. Yeah, good. I'm so glad to hear that, Doug.
It's got a big cult following. Yeah.
It does. Oh, I didn't realize that. Yeah. That's wonderful news. Well, for those of you who don't know, it's basically a twist on the King Midas story, in which the hero of Cat's Cradle, when he touches something, it doesn't turn to gold, it turns to ice, which still blows my mind. I just think it's such a fascinating idea.
Yeah.
So he said the reason he got that idea was, as we writers often need to do, we need to make money because we're not making that much money on our books. So he went to work at a think tank just over a summer. And while he was there, this idea occurred to him. So I'm in Santa Barbara with the same husband, and, you know, I got to get a job. And I think, I wonder if there are any think tanks around. And by George, there was. And it was a General Electric think tank. It was privately owned by the company. But we did so much defense work. And that's why I ended up with a top secret clearance. And the questions they asked, you know, the paperwork one filled out, it was extraordinary. And there were posters on the walls, loose lips, sink ships. I kid you not, from World War II, but, you know, it's still a good example of when you talk, you can reveal things you should not be revealing. And every time I went from one room to another room, I had to punch in my code. And I was, unfortunately, one of those bad girls, because I would periodically forget to bring my badge. And then there'd be there'd be trouble because I forgot my badge. And so they got, so they kind of had the Gale rule. And they knew that and they would just wave me through because there was all this security. But it was a wonderful experience.
Well,
ideas were bouncing off the walls, and so were the scientists. It was a crazy atmosphere.
Well, when they were interviewing you for that, did the questions they asked you, did you get the feeling they already knew the answers?
No, because this was a lot longer time ago.
Yeah.
And it was a more innocent period than it is
right
now. We did not have nearly the amount of observation and data collection that we have now. So, no, and honestly, how many people remember the last four addresses that they lived at? It was awful.
Or even cities they lived in.
True.
Well, so you got this top secret clearance, and I'm assuming that this is a fraternity that you are in for life. And
no.
So you have to kind of, things that you knew then, you still can't talk about, but you find yourself kind of on the verge and say, well, wait a minute, I can't go there.
No, you know, this is what's so, one of the things that was so interesting to me is my clearance lasted only 20 years.
Oh, okay.
And when I look back now, I don't even remember a lot of the stuff I worked on. And, of course, the hardware and the software is so terribly outdated now that, you know, nobody cares. A friend of mine was OSS, which, of course, is the World War II forerunner of CIA. He had 55 years clearance.
Wow.
And he was in his 80s when he could finally talk about it. And we were at a party, and he grabbed my arm. He said, "Gail, I've got to tell you something." And then he burst out with this, that he'd been with OSS. He'd had it bottled up, you know, for so many years.
That's,
he couldn't remember anything either, you know.
So there's an expiration date on in the spy world.
For some of us, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Well, I know that there are those out there now because some of them are my friends, and they can't talk about it.
Sure. Well,
yeah.
let's talk. You mentioned the OSS. Let's back up a little bit. Mm-hmm. Why was the CIA needed in the first place, and how did it actually come about? How did we end up with the Central Intelligence Agency?
There's a wonderful quote from a Secretary of War, I believe, maybe World War I, who said, "Gentlemen do not read other gentlemen's mail." And, of course, that attitude in wartime in particular is very dangerous. And there are a lot of jokes about intelligence gathering. One of them is it's the second oldest profession, you know, after being
right.
a lady of ill repute. But the reality is, well, one way that CIA likes to explain it is there are actually four legs of government, not three, the three-legged stool. Actually, it's a four-legged stool because there's Congress, there's the Supreme Court, there's the presidency, and the fourth leg is intelligence. Because intelligence, when it's working properly, is to give information to the president and ultimately to Congress so that they can make informed decisions. Also, it's critical for making good policy for our international relations. So not to have intelligence in this day and age would be utterly insane because everybody else has it. Then, of course, you come to issues of, you know, what is fair, what's unfair, what's right, what's wrong. Then you get into questions of ethics and morality, which, you know, is always a sticky wicket.
Especially with the CIA.
Oh, yeah. But the CIA came about, I think Harry Truman signed it into law in 1947. The forerunner was the OSS, which I had mentioned earlier, the Office of Strategic Services, which ran all through World War II. And it was an incredibly important addition to our ability to win the war. They were amazing, brave people, and there are so many people in CIA today and in the other intelligence agencies that we have in this country who are heroic in what they do. We, you know, we have problems. There's no human organization that's not going to make mistakes, and occasionally, we hope not, but they do make terrible decisions that people pay for.
Yep. Now, shortly after, you mentioned World War II, and shortly after that, obviously, Europe got divided up and the Iron Curtain fell, Churchill's famous Iron Curtain. And then the Cold War grew, and, you know, we grew up with that. And the Cold War was real, and it was duck and cover, and there was all that stuff, and the nuclear arms race. What changes in espionage, breadth, depth, and techniques, things like that, did the Cold War spin off for the CIA and other intelligence agencies?
I just love that question. In some ways, it's difficult to answer. The easy answer is that we grew more sophisticated in all technology. From the smallest cameras that we, and audio listening devices that we, the very tiny, minuscule devices that we were able to create, up into these marvelous satellites that circled the globe, and they could hone in and read a newspaper. They could read a movie ticket from thousands of miles away. So those were the big changes. Then what we saw were the fluctuations of wanting to spend money on the intelligence agencies and not. And usually when we were spending a lot of money on technology, particularly the satellites, we would tend to cut back on human intelligence, which was, of course, a huge mistake, but we would start feeling secure, and then we would back off. This particularly happened at when the Cold War ended in 91. The wall went down in 89, but 91 really was when the Cold War was over. And I remember Senator Moynihan of New York introduced a bill to Congress to disband the CIA. I think it was largely a sort of gesture, but it showed how little interest people had in continuing an intelligence agency. We were tired. The Cold War devastated us, didn't it? We were exhausted. And I remember I had international journalist friends who couldn't even get a job. And they were globetrotters, but nobody wanted to really read in the newspaper about what was going on overseas. It was a very long and nasty Cold War. So in the 90s, the intelligence services lost a lot of personnel. They didn't hire. Human intelligence was considered to be, well, what's the point? You know, we're the last standing superpower. And then, of course, 9/11 happened, and we realized that we had fallen down on the job. We had not been funding CIA. We had not been spending money on developing human intelligence in the various corners of the world that were potential trouble spots. We'd really screwed up. And since then, I think we've really done a much better job of being a more balanced intelligence service. But it hasn't been easy, and there have been some horrible things have happened along the way, too.
Well, obviously the technological changes have been, you know, in that world out of necessity have evolved dramatically. You know, you mentioned satellites, three golf balls and stuff like that. What other cool things have come along in the spy world that evolved through the Cold War and, you know, on up into the 90s and 9/11, et cetera? What other techniques have spies started using now? I know a lot of our listeners are writers, and they like to write thrillers, and they like to write spy thrillers like you do. What kind of cool toys are out there now?
Oh, gosh, there are so many, aren't there? I write about a lot of them in The Last Spy Master, and my favorites are the teeny, teeny, tiny computers that are like the size of grains of sand, and if you throw several, you know, a handful into a building, they will go off and report back to each individual little piece of information. Then you add them all up in software on your computer, and you can get you can find out how many people are there. You can get the room temperature. You can get audio. It's an astonishing ability that these little tiny sand grain computers can give you. Another one that I love that I'm seeing more and more talk about is the invisible cloak. That it's a technology that there are several different technologies involved. One of them is that the cloak on the back reflects on the front what's on the back, so that literally you pretty much can't see the human being that's hiding in it. These are coming off the drawing board now. Of course, the ability that the military and our military intelligence people have developed, where they take small computers with them everywhere, where they can constantly get information from people who can see what's on the other side of the hill, and instead of going to a central point where it would be where there would be some kind of reception area, central command, if you will, and then shot to our spy. It goes directly from the spotter to the spy. We've cut out a lot of the middleman problems that we saw at the beginning of our going into Afghanistan after 9/11. It's really fun, but at the same time, we're still using dead drops.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. How are things still the same? What didn't change, and what is critical in that infrastructure that you mentioned human intelligence and how important that is, and I'm assuming most of these would be human-to-human interactions of some respect that we did 50 years ago that we're still doing now?
Yes, we are. We do brush passes. You know, the UN is, it's said, I don't know whether it's true, but I kind of believe it, that the UN has more spies per square inch than any other acre in the world.
I believe it.
And there is so much intelligence gathering going on in UN headquarters and at the various parties that when somebody really wants a piece of information to go back home and they want to make sure that it's secure, they give it to somebody who gets on a plane and hand carries it home.
Wow.
That tells you how far we've come, and yet...
and yet we haven't moved an inch.
Yeah, isn't it interesting? Honestly, it's hard to make stuff up that isn't true now or going to be true.
I think that's
look at what's going on with drones. I mean, when I first started studying drones, the idea that you could weaponize drones to the degree that we have now was really way off in the future. And I started studying them, about 5-8 years ago. It's just the technology has advanced so quickly.
Yeah, I remember.
Now we all need to look out our bedroom windows.
Yeah, I remember a few years ago I was at Thriller Fest and I met the husband of one of the writers there, and he was Air Force personnel and he flew drones. He flew them. I think he was stationed in Texas somewhere, or maybe Utah. But anyway, he flew drones. I mean, he flew the you know, on the other side of the world, sitting at a console, which is pretty cool. And I said, you know, these things are getting so small, they're like little model airplanes. He said, try the size of your thumb. And so they have those little hummingbirds now that they can send into buildings and even smaller things that fly around and gather information. It's amazing technology.
Mm-hmm. It is. And I'm pleased to see Congress, or whoever it is, I can't remember now, wrestling with ways to legally control the use of them. Because that's scary technology.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. It's both wonderful and it's frightening. It's both save your life, but it also becomes Big Brother. You know, and that's that dichotomy that we, you know, in our society, we have to fight with all the time.
Yes, and because you and I both write crime novels, in essence, we keep thinking what the bad guys can do with them.
Yeah, exactly. It's the bad guys that are fun, you know.
Yeah, right.
The heroes are usually boring unless there's a really good bad guy.
Exactly. Yeah. I agree with you 100%.
Well, let me ask you, how does counter-espionage work? How do people counter these things and turn the page back on the person who's spying?
Oh, you know, that's another terrific question, because I think people get confused about what counter-espionage is. And basically, it's what we do to detect enemy espionage or their attacks and to stop it, and if possible, to turn the attempt back against them. One of my very favorite examples of that was a Cold War example, the KGB. The Soviet Union was in so much trouble, not just economically, but because of the totalitarian system. The ability of scientists to free think and to develop and to grow was greatly hampered. And they didn't have the time, they didn't have the space, they just couldn't do what we in the United States take for granted. So the KGB's Directorate T, which was the Scientific and Technical Directorate, spent a great deal of time stealing secrets, particularly technology.
Exactly.
and then they would reverse engineer it. And of course, the Chinese have been doing it for, you know, all of the countries that aren't us. I think we probably do it too, although I have read very little about that. Anyway, we had great resources during the Cold War. We had well-placed spies, a lot of places that I think are probably still not revealed today. And one of the things that we would do is we would find out when one of their people was sniffing around one of our technologies or one of our allies' technologies, and when we found out about it, we would often allow them to steal it. But we would allow them to steal it with either a backdoor, where we could use that as an ability to peer further into what they were doing, or with some kind of bad engineering inside that would make the darn thing explode, or simply slowly work itself down to where it stopped working, and they would be frustrated pulling out the hair because they couldn't figure out why it wasn't working now. In other words, we sort of booby-trapped a lot of stuff. And that's what the best kind of counter-espionage is.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to take a brief break here, and we'll be back on the backside, and we're going to talk about some specific cases and about some of Gail's books and how she comes up with her wonderful ideas and plot lines. So stay with us. We'll be back in a few minutes.
All it takes is the perfect shot. You can take your shot this year in New York City during the 10-year anniversary of Thriller Fest. Take aim during Craft Fest, Pitch Fest, Thriller Fest, and new this year, Career Fest, all designed to help you hit your mark. Meet the pros, like 2015 Thriller Master Nelson DeMille, Silver Bullet recipient Kathy Reichs, with spotlight guests Greg Isles, Charlaine Harris, and Mark Billingham. And let the best help you zero in on your career target at the Grand Hyatt in New York City, July 7th through the 11th, 2015. It's time. Take your shot. Register now. www.thrillerfest.com.
Join Stephen King, Peter Straub, Ellen Datlow, Ramsey Campbell, Jonathan Mayberry, and hundreds more in the Horror Writers Association's campaign, HorrorSelfies.com. Take a selfie with any written message promoting reading or with your favorite book. Check in at HorrorSelfies.com to submit your photo, and you can win signed books. Help us let the world know why horror is important and submit your selfie today. That's www.HorrorSelfies.com.
Okay, everybody. We can now finally say it because it is official. We have dates and times for those new shows that we've been talking about here starting up. First, of course, we want to tell you that Crime and Science Radio is going to be back here on January the 17th at their normal time. And then they do every other Saturday after that. So then the next one is going to be January the 31st. They already have some wonderful guests lined up here in store for you this year. So make sure you don't miss anything that's got going on. And that's hosted by DP Lyle and Jan Burke. Now, the first of our two new shows, myself, John Robb, and Jeff Ayers, are going to take fans inside the pages with Beyond the Cover. Now, this is a one-hour show, and what it's going to do is it's going to feature book reviews, live author interviews, book business, publishing, marketing help, and so much more. Jeff is a reviewer that has done hundreds and hundreds of reviews for Associated Press and many other magazines, other outlets that he does. And he is going to have a lot of insight and a lot of stuff that we're going to be sharing back and forth from the different sides of the business. So make sure that you don't, you know, miss any of that. You're going to hear live book reviews on the air. So it's just going to be a great all-around show. The first show for that one is going to start here on January the 12th. That's Monday. It's going to be 7:30 Pacific time. And then it's going to be every other Monday at 7:30 p.m. Pacific. Now, the next show, that's going to be featuring best-selling author Stephen James, which, of course, you know him from his Patrick Bauer series. His latest book, Checkmate, which is the last book in the series, has just been released. And he is also going to be co-hosted with blogger, author, radio personality, and so much more, Jose Castillo. Now, the art of storytelling lies within their show, and it is called The Story Blender. They have a website that's hopefully going to be up here before their first show airs. Now, authors, screenwriters, artists, actors, and many more are going to give you a lot of different views on just how to tell a story. So every author, wannabe author, new author, you're thinking about becoming an author, you don't know where to start, you need to listen to this show. Now, the first show is going to air here on January the 23rd. That's going to be at 7 p.m. Pacific time, and then that's going to run every other Friday after that. So we got you lined up here. Every other Friday, every other Monday, every Saturday, you're going to have Suspense Radio, Crime and Science Radio. Certain Sundays, you're going to have Suspense Radio One-on-One. So, of course, all the shows now are going to be available to listen on demand. You can go to iTunes and subscribe to the podcast when the show's done. It just goes right into your iPhone or iPad or whatever you listen to, and you can just search Suspense Radio. You'll see the magazine cover, and there you go. Of course, you can always go to blogtalkradio.com/suspensemagazine. That's the main homepage for the radio show. So do yourself a favor. Go check out all the great shows we got going up. We only do this because you guys like listening to us. So there you go. And we will see you all, real soon. So very excited to be able to share the information with you. So enjoy. And I can't wait to see all your comments. Of course, you can always do everything. editor@suspensemagazine.com. Share your comments, suggestions, anything about the shows. Of course, after you've heard them. I mean, you don't have to yell at me before you heard them. So do it after you heard them and just let us know what you guys think. And hopefully we'll be bringing some new stuff to you. And welcome back, everybody, here after the break again on Crime and Science Radio. Today's show is called Spy versus Spy versus Spy, an interview with the Queen of Espionage, Gail Lenz. So let's get right back to the show again with your hosts, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome back, everybody. We're having a great discussion with the Queen of Espionage, Gail Lenz. And I should also mention she's also one of the two co-founders of International Thriller Writers. And lo and behold, she writes thrillers. Who would have thunk that? And like many thriller authors, Gail, you write about what you know about. So you write spy thrillers. And I think I read where in The Coil, at least I know in The Coil, you used the famous Georgi Markov case as kind of a jumping off point for that. So can you kind of tell us a little bit about Markov and what that was about and how it bled into your novel?
It's such an interesting case and tragic, too. He was a noted dissident from Bulgaria, and he was critical of the regime. In those days, there was, of course, a communist head of state. His name was Todor Zhivkov. And Zhivkov got really, really bent out of shape because Markov was writing endless critiques of the regime and how Bulgaria lacked freedom and the cost to the people, the poverty, the intellectual and emotional starvation that they were experiencing. And Zhivkov really had it. So he went to the Politburo and said, we've got to do something about it. Well, as it turns out, the KGB really hated dissidents too. And they sort of had a policy, and actually they had a real directorate that was devoted to killing off dissidents because that was, in their belief, it was a way to discourage people from defecting and becoming dissidents. So they set it up so that Markov was in London. He was about to step onto Waterloo Bridge, and somebody bumped into him. He could feel somebody bump into him. He turned around. He felt a little pain in his thigh, and somebody had dropped an umbrella, picked it up, and stepped into a cab that was waiting. And he was fine. And then the next day, he got extremely ill. He was taken to the hospital, recounted to the doctors this odd incident, and then died. They couldn't figure out, they thought it was a heart attack, and the doctors did do a post-mortem. They found this tiny little pellet in his thigh. There was no poison associated with it, but they suspected ricin, which of course is made from castor oil beans, and it's, Doug, you can talk to that much better than I can. And it doesn't leave a trace in the body. The political fallout from this was devastating. A lot of defectors went into hiding because, of course, it showed that no one was safe and that the KGB's arm was long, although Bulgarian Secret Service did it, not the Soviets. But what the Soviets did do, which I thought was very clever, was they bought a whole bundle of American-made umbrellas so that if the umbrella was found, they hoped that would mislead and not come back to the communist intelligence services, and they had put a small gun, a tiny tiny little gun, in the point of the umbrella, and that's what had shot the recent pellet into Markov. It was and he had a 2-year-old child. He'd been recently married. It was and he was brilliant, talented, devoted. It was terrible.
Yeah.
And of course, it's one that's been recounted over and over and over. And then I used it in the book, as I recall, to explain how horrible this the assassin that comes to be called the Carnivore is, that he was responsible for it. Although, of course, in real life, he was not.
Yeah. And of course, recently the Russian guy that died a few years ago because of polonium poisoning.
Litvinenko.
Yeah, exactly, Litvinenko. Exactly, and a similar situation.
It was, and what's interesting to me is how the UK repressed the widow's lawsuit to uncover the information that the UK collected, you know, the police information. And finally, as I understand, the court system is releasing it, and she is proceeding with a lawsuit. I don't know how this is going to play out, but I don't think we want to forget these things.
No, not at all. You know, there's casualties. There's casualties in the spy versus spy war, but let's play fair.
And it was so. It's when they're so outrageous,
right,
that one says to oneself, "This is not just simply a political assassination. What this is a message."
Yeah.
This is a message that's being sent. And you will notice that quite a few of the oligarchs who retired to England, or escaped to England, I guess, and they were on Putin's bad list, have died under various circumstances, and much too young.
I'm shocked.
suicide, home invasion, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, things
nonsense.
That could be written off as the flotsam and jetsam of life, things happen. But then they start piling up.
Well, and the people who are part of that world, they know what this is. They know exactly what this is.
Exactly.
They know it's the warning. And where can they be safe? Now, I don't have bleed a lot for these oligarchs, because they raped the country of money. They've taken so much money out of that of Russia that is. It's appalling. I was listening to somebody on the talk on the air the other night, and they said that they'd studied the finances of this whole thing, and it's their opinion that Bill Gates is not the richest person on earth. It is Vladimir Putin, and they estimate that he's stolen about $200 billion, and he has it in various hidden accounts and gems and all this other stuff. Yeah, and we wonder why Russia is so poor.
Yeah, exactly. $200 billion will get you well in a hurry.
Oh, my gosh. You know, that's bigger than most governments' GDP.
Oh, yeah, it's bigger than 95% of the government, 99% of the governments, I guess.
Exactly.
That's an adult number.
Yeah.
Well,
speaking of
nasty organizations, also in the call, you created the highly secretive Nautilus Group, which is a great, 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 great thing. But it was based on something in real life. I think I read it was based on the Bilderberg Group. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is?
Yes. And that was another thing that I found absolutely fascinating and wanted to write about it. I think I'm too young to remember this, and certainly you are too, but after World War II, Europe was in chaos. There were so many displaced people. There was tremendous hunger, tremendous poverty, and it was like a powder keg waiting to go off again. So several people got together, and Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands was one of the primary people. There were a couple of spies involved and some military people, and they thought, you know, we've got to do something so that tribalism, if you will, nationalism in Europe doesn't lead us into yet another world war. So they first met in 1952 in a little apartment in Paris, and said, "Do we want to form an organization?" And they agreed that they did. Now, at that point, there were no Americans involved, but they said, "You know, if this is going to work, we have to bring in the United States." So the next year, 2 years later, in in Bilderberg, in the Bilderberg Hotel in Holland. They had their first formal conference, and the guess who paid for it? CIA, and it was supported also by the Netherlands government because it was taking place in their country. What I found, so there are several interesting elements to this story. One of them was, in this group, by the way, is still in existence, and it meets almost every year. Every once in a while it skips a year, but that's an aberration. And they meet all over the world, usually in hotels or resorts that can have tremendous security so they can keep people out. The point in the beginning was to unite Europe, show Europeans that they had a common cause to work for peace. And there were a lot of military people there, too, because they didn't want another war. Everybody was done with wars. So they worked together. Out of this group came the European Common Market, where trade regulations were minimized so that the countries could trade among themselves to give them stronger economic footing so people had jobs, you know, they had homes to go to again. And from the European Common Market came, of course, the European Union and ultimately the euro. So all of this was really good stuff that came out of the Bilderberg meetings. Now, today, almost no military people go. Primarily, it's bankers and politicians and heads of huge corporations. So you can see there's been this shift in the world that is reflected in the Bilderberg Group. There are a lot of rumors that swirl around this group. You hear very little about it in the United States, although they do occasionally meet here. The last time that I remember they met in the United States was in Crystal City, which is just outside Washington, D.C. They often meet just before the G8 so that those people who are going to the G8 have managed to talk about a lot of the topics that will be covered at the G8 meeting. Almost all of the presidents of the United States have attended, oftentimes before they ran for the presidency. There are people who claim that there's a vetting process that goes on, that some candidates are going to be supported more than others, that they to achieve a Bilderberg approval means money, it means support, it means contacts, it means all kinds of things. I had, from the documents that I saw, Bill Clinton went before he was ran for the presidency. George Bush is gone. The number. Heads, the Graham family went. They're the owners of the owners of the Washington Post, but we don't cover it in our newspapers and are on television. In Europe, it's covered, and in Canada, when they met outside Toronto, it was covered. And I all I know is if one stops and thinks, 120 of the world's leaders are meeting in one place, and we do not see any coverage in the United States. That makes me uncomfortable. I don't know how you feel about it, but that does make me terribly uncomfortable. So that's the downside. What exactly goes on? What they're saying is, you know, we're like Davos. You know, we're like Aspen. We get together, we talk. And I believe that. I truly believe that. But we all know the importance of networking. We all know that when you have face-to-face conversations, you can often accomplish things that bureaucracies can slow down. I don't know what's going on there. Hmm. It makes me uncomfortable.
But it's great fodder for fiction.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. And when I first started investigating this, I couldn't find out anything. I found out they existed from a very, very right-wing tabloid newspaper that I had stumbled on because I'm just an inveterate researcher. And then in those days, the Internet really wasn't what it is today. And I would go in the library, and I would sit for days poring through various catalogs and so forth looking for any kind of a mention. I remember when I found something in the Toronto Star, I got so excited. Anyway, now today you can go online, and you will find so much stuff about the Bilderbergers. And that makes me happy.
Yeah. You also, in Mesmerize, created an FBI mole that was way up the food chain. And obviously, we hear about those that are very high level. Obviously, there's others that are lower level that do less damage, as it were. But where are the U.S. secrets most vulnerable to being breached? Is it moles like this? Is it just the old loose lips sink ships? Is it hackers that dig in with a thing, or is it Congress? I mean, where's the biggest loophole, you think, in our intelligence right now?
Oh, I think that's a great question. I want to back up just a tiny bit, though, to talk about the mole that I created in Mesmerize. I wrote that book after Aldrich Ames had been uncovered, and there had been quite a few CIA moles who had been uncovered. So, and I was looking at, I was doing my usual research. I kept thinking, there's got to be somebody in the FBI, because some of the stuff that had been leaked or revealed and come back to us wasn't CIA material. It was FBI material. So I said, okay, I'm going to create an FBI, a mole high up in the FBI. His name is going to be Robert. By God, within the same month that Mesmerized was published, Robert Hansen was revealed to have been perhaps the worst, most damaging spy, traitor that we'd ever had, FBI. Wasn't that a coincidence? I mean, just every time I think about it, I think, wow. But in answer to your question, all of those things that you say, I think, are true. From what I can figure out, the sources are endless for finding information that we don't want to get out. I was thinking about Daniel Ellsberg, of course, way back in the past, and he was working in defense, and that's when he revealed the Pentagon Papers in 1971, revealing about what our lies that were going on in Vietnam. And then, of course, we've got WikiLeaks, where they accept so many, whether it's true or not. That's the only thing that disturbs me about WikiLeaks, too, is so much of the stuff that they leak, we don't know how true it is, and yet we're supposed to, I think, accept it on face values. And then Bradley Manning, who did a lot of damage, too. We tend to hear more about the high-profile spies who do a lot of damage, I'm with you. I tend to wonder about clerks. We know, for instance, that in the past, secretaries and clerks and mailroom personnel, they have access to a tremendous amount of information, and they're often a lot easier to get to. I don't know that one could ever say that there's just one area that is more open to giving up secrets than another. But you know, Pollard, what was Pollard's first name? Daniel Pollard?
I think it was.
I was invited to speak to a spy symposium a few years ago, and I was talking to some of the folks there, and I said, what's going on with this, with Pollard? I said, he's been incarcerated, I think at that point it was 30 years. And I said, isn't it time to let him go and send him back to Israel and never let him come back here? And, oh, no, boy, did they bristle. Whatever Pollard gave up was so important that every time somebody comes close to saying, let's let him go, it's been forever, the CIA says, oh, no.
Interesting.
I'm very interested in what...
I'd like
there.
To know. If you find out, let me know.
Okay, we'll do a book.
Now, in The Last Spy Master, you created the amazing Jay Tice. Why don't you tell... Yeah, great character. Why don't you tell us a little bit about him and kind of the characteristics he has and that a good real-life spy as well as a fictional spy must have.
Oh, he was so much fun, and he was difficult because I wanted to write about a great spy. But in order, of course, to write about anyone, there are always weaknesses, there are problems. And he came out of an abused background, but he was one. There are many people who are abused as children, who do not end up as serial killers.
They end up as spies.
They have some resilience within them that is very inspirational. Here's a little thing about this particular personality type that I was working on with him. When they fail at something that they feel is really important to them, they tend to set higher goals for the next time because they want to erase that bad past with something that's telling or inspiring or motivational in a success. And they tend to be realistic in crisis. They're not blindly optimistic, although they always have hope and optimism. They analyze their disasters, and then they make changes that are appropriate to what they learn. And then they search for meaning and results. So there's an intelligence. If you talk to people, and when one talks to people who are in intelligence work, they usually are very intelligent. They also, the greatest ones are focused, and then they're charming because, see, they're working with people all the time. One of the jobs of the spy is to convince people in other countries to betray their countries. And being charming is a great aid in doing that. But while you're being charming, you have to be duplicitous, too. So there's this really complicated stew that goes on in great spy masters. There's also a downfall because they can start to feel impervious to being held accountable. Their egos can get really big. They can think that they are much more important than they really are. You can see there's this sort of gradual changing of the personality as they become better and better at what they're doing. So when I was creating Jay Tice, I took all of that into account. And I said, okay, so he's been through all of that. Who is he now? And I gave him a big job to do in Last Spymaster, where he has to uncover a terrible plot. And he has to do it in such a way that he grows in the end. And I liked him. Writing him was so much fun because he was tricky. He was a real trickster, a real trick master. And he was always poking at people who thought who were his enemies and thought they had outwitted him, but in the end he would turn the tables on them. I liked it.
Yeah, and he's a great character. Fantastic character.
Thank you.
Well, you mentioned earlier that Putin may be the richest guy in the world. Well, he's not the only dictator, as it were, that's raped and pillaged the treasury as it is. And in your latest book, which is called The Assassins, I understand it deals with a retired spy, a bunch of assassins, and Saddam Hussein's stolen cash. Can you tell us a little bit about that story and what we can expect? I think it comes out June 30th. Is that right? Something like that?
That's right. Thank
yeah.
you. Yes, it is. And, there were two things that got me really interested in that. I like treasure hunts. I don't know how you feel about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I really love them. And Saddam Hussein, various people, sources estimate that he had 40 to $70 billion in wealth when we and our allies went into Iraq. Where did that money go? This is a big treasure hunt. The United States assumed that we would be able to find a lot of it, if not all of it, and then use part of it to finance what we were doing there, but also then return the rest of it to the Iraqi people because he was doing the same thing to Iraq that Putin and his cronies are doing to Russia. Well, we only found a few billion. The rest is still out there. And the reports that I was reading, the people that I were talking to were saying that he did what we would expect him to do. He had it placed in many different sources, in Switzerland and Liechtenstein and Cabo San Lucas and under various fronts. He may have been the only person that knew where all of those fronts were, but that's unlikely. Two of his sons were, of course, killed. He had two daughters whose husbands he killed and a couple of widows. And my guess is that all of them know a little piece of the puzzle. But I suspect, considering our abilities, that if any of them really knew where it was, the whole thing, or a big portion of it, we would know by now. So somebody knows, or else it's, the other thing is that where he placed it in various institutions, they may know it's his, and they may simply have absorbed it. And no one will ever know the difference.
Exactly.
Or they could transfer it out. Anyway, I wanted to find that money in the book, okay? Which I did.
Yeah.
I'll tell you that. That may be a tiny spoiler, but not too big a spoiler. So that was one of the things that I was interested in. The other thing was, because I've written so much about spies, I've also written a lot about assassins. And I really delved into the psyche of spies, but I really wanted to find out who assassins were. And I think that most of us who are not really in the business, we kind of see assassins as sort of the same kind of person. You know, they're all alike. They're killers. They don't have a conscience. They're probably smart or they're dumb, but they're pretty much all alike. And I thought, you know, I bet that's not the truth. And so when I started doing my research on that, I came to that conclusion that, yeah, they are all different. So I have six assassins who are master assassins. They came out of the Cold War. They've been at it a long time. And in that business, if you survive 20 or 30 years, you know you're good because the attrition rate is very high. And so they're pitted against each other. It's a game of last man standing. And one of the end results of this will be finding Saddam's missing billions.
Cool, cool. Well, I know if you had six geese, they'd be a gaggle, and if you had six crows, they'd be a murder. I wonder what you call six assassins.
You call them the assassins. That's what you call them.
Exactly. Well, Gail, it has been an absolute pleasure, and I know our listeners are thrilled. We've got to be thrilled with this and learned a lot. And as everyone knows, there'll be a lot of links up on the websites, both at crimeandscienceradio.com and on my site, where to Gail's website, her books, and some other interesting stuff. So, Gail, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.